survived the legal challenge. So what's next for newly minted Councilman Terrence Freeman? Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on the 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Charles Griggs, in for Melissa Ross. And we're always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Coming up, a conversation with Jacksonville City Councilman Terrence Freeman. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, we'll be marking Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And also, we'll take a look ahead at the Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Fest this weekend. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, Terrence Freeman says he's moving forward after a lawsuit challenging his appointment to the Jacksonville City Council was dismissed earlier this month. Freeman was appointed by Governor Rick Scott to replace City Councilman Reginald Brown, who faces federal charges. Jacksonville City Councilman Terrence Freeman joins me now here in the studio live. And to get in on the conversation again, give us a call, 549-2937. Terrence Freeman, thank you and good morning for being here.
Good morning, Charles, and thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start from the beginning. Let's talk a little bit about how you got here. When you were appointed back in July to the Jacksonville City Council by Governor Rick Scott, because the sitting councilman, District 10, Reginald Brown, was facing indictment. The governor then suspended Reginald Brown and put you in place there. How did your name get on the list? Did you apply for it? And what made you feel like you were qualified to serve District 10?
Well, and that was a very popular question when all of this came around. And first of all, I can't go without thanking my family and my wife, my girls, for just being tremendous supporters of our journey into serving the residents of District 10. It is an honor to have been appointed by Governor Scott, and I consider it one of the greatest honors of my life, short of my wedding and the birth of my kids. How did we come to this process? I was coaching. I was actually in New York coaching, and this information started coming out. And I started hearing from residents in District 10. And I know that surprises some people who hadn't heard of me.
Residents of District 10?
Yes, sir. And several have come out to town halls and have spoken as well. The level of mentorship, coaching, teaching, I taught on the west side and was a principal for 12 years in close proximity to the district. So I followed the necessary steps after consulting with my family of completing all of the necessary paperwork and submitting it all and just following the process as it was detailed in the information.
So most people think that you probably had an inside track because you are a Republican, right?
Yes,
Republican
sir.
Governor.
Proud Republican.
And
yes, sir.
So when you applied for the position, did you expect to be appointed?
I gave myself about a 0.02% chance.
So when did you think that you really had a real shot at it? Were you contacted by anyone?
No, sir. I really did not feel like I was going to be a front runner or that I was until I got the actual call from staff saying you are the one. And that was very close proximity to.
Did you have an interview with the governor?
I get to meet with people? I definitely had conversations with folk and just asking in those conversations, you know, their thoughts of the type of leadership that I've brought to the table. Would it be something that they saw would be beneficial for the district from an administrative side point? I'd already had the support from from many of my close friends in the district, residents in the district.
Okay, so one of the big controversy about your appointment was, you know, not the fact that you're Republican, but that you're a Republican who did not originally live in the district. The question around the lawsuit was that you didn't originally live there. You didn't live there at the time of your appointment. When you're talking about that to your constituents,
yes, sir.
How do you explain that? So you say that you were living in the district, or did you move specifically for the appointment?
So that is probably the easiest question that I respond to from constituents, because their question is do you live here in the district? Mm-hmm. And my response is absolutely. And they said, then we're fine. Let's move forward. Mm-hmm. How can we work to get this district caught up? Because there's been a lapse. There's several weeks went without any representation in that district. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they have someone who's shown up every day, I've gone to homes, I've gone and seen their issues. They become real to me. Mm-hmm. And I've offered real solutions for those real problems.
Do you feel comfortable that folks throughout the district, you know, especially those who are Democratic residents who feel like this opportunity may have been hijacked for them, do you feel comfortable that answer represents satisfaction to the representation of the district. In other words, if you move to the district just to become a council member, is it right for you to do that?
And I'm not quite sure I've heard that line of questioning from the residents of the district, but I know the response they've heard from me is, and when they ask what qualifies you or why, it all starts with a love of God. I tell them, and I shared my story. My story was never really shared from the very beginning. Son of a Baptist preacher. My mother was a social worker for 30 plus years. My brother started preaching at the age of 12, ordained at 15, and is a bishop up in South Carolina. Serving is all I've ever known. It's a part of my DNA. When I completed my professional baseball career and went back into a world of education, I landed in Jacksonville in 1999. Could have chosen many professions, but I went in education. Kids are the driving force for what brought me into this world of public policy. So when I share with them a love of God, a love of people, a heart to serve, the relationships that I have with the business community, the relationships that I have with the administration, with the leadership, I said, who better to serve and represent the district in this short period? Because there's going to be an election in March. Mm-hmm. Who better to represent the district than someone that comes with these credentials?
Okay, so we have a lot to get to here with City Councilman Terrence Freeman. The number to call is 549-2937 if you'd like to get into the conversation. And we're going to get a caller in here. Stanley, are you on the line? Hello, Stanley, are you there? Okay, we'll try him again. Stanley, are you there? Okay, we're having some trouble. We lost Stanley, but we'll try to get him back. So moving forward in the conversation, do you know how many town hall meetings have you been holding? I understand that you've been holding town hall meetings in the district, and you've been hearing from constituents that this is a good thing. How many have you had, and is it something that hasn't been done or more frequently been done, or what are you hearing from your constituents now?
So to date, I've had at least five town hall meetings. The district runs from the Trout River all the way down to Collins Road. So to do my best to try to get to all parts of our district. But we've had, I understand that access is a challenge in the district. And so in the most recent town hall meeting, I've been bringing the city departments to the Legend Center, to District 10, and from Public Works, JSO, you name it, I had them there so that any questions that the residents of District 10 would have, instead of coming to me and then me coming back to downtown, getting answers and going back out to them, they were able to get those answers real time right there on the spot.
Okay. So we're going to try again. We have Lee on the north side. Lee, you're on the line on First Coast Connect. Good morning. Sorry, Lee, good morning.
Good morning. Can you guys hear me okay?
We got you. Very good.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Councilman Freeman, one of the longstanding issues in that district has been the septic tank problem. And we've had mayor after mayor, administration after administration said that they were going to make it one of their goals to get rid of the septic tanks in the district. So far to date, that has not happened. Now, with you being in the majority party, what can you do to move that project forward so that the residents in that district can feel safer about their water?
And thank you for the question, Lee. That's a very good question. We've heard over and over again about the neglect in District 10 regarding to infrastructure. So how are you going to, you just talked about your relationships. How are you going to use those relationships to move some of these projects forward?
Well, yes, sir. That was one of the first things upon coming in that I did was to get an update of where we're at. And septic tanks, definitely at the top of the list of many residents in the district. And so it became a top priority of mine. We know that is a big issue to deal with. To date, where we're at, Biltmore, that project is fully funded. It actually scored the highest, and it was out of the top three, number one.
Mm-hmm. So that means it's going to be a priority.
It is a priority, yes.
And so will it have a timetable to it?
The timetable will just be that continued discussion of the budget and mm-hmm. getting in and getting early and fighting. Coming in when I did, with such a limited time leading up to things, it was definitely brought out that it was of importance to me. But trying to identify those dollars and find them, because it's not a small number.
But that's one of the issues that
infrastructure, the public safety and infrastructure, two of the top priorities.
We understand that you're working with the administration to make sure that this gets done as a priority.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think we got Stanley back now. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lee, for that. Stanley, I think we have you this time. Are you there?
Yes.
Stanley, good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this opportunity here. My main concern with Mr. Freeman is your ethics. Even though someone select you or want you to represent a community, what I'm talking about as far as the governor is concerned, what about your ethics? Because as a person who understands the political system here, my concern is that's a democratic area for many years over in the African-American community over there. And my concern here, once again, I'd like to tell me more about your ethics, because I do not support you when it comes to your ethics here and the reason why they made that decision, why you made that decision to select that office, right. Take that office.
All right. Thank you, Stanley, for your call. And Terrence, that's going to be a continuing, between Democrats and Republicans, why would a Republican represent a mostly Democratic district? How do you answer that? How do you answer Mr. Scott's concerns?
Well, I thank you for the question. I reference it to my time serving. Prior to this appointment, I was an assistant in City Hall for a city council member, and I answered phone calls from residents throughout our city. And what I've shared with residents of District 10 is I don't ever recall getting a phone call of someone saying that I have a Democratic pothole on the interstate that I need you to come and fix. I have a Republican tree that's in the right of way that's blocking kids' ability to walk to school, and I need Public Works to come and get it. What they tell me is we have a problem, and can you help us? And so when I hear that, I understand it. I understand where it's coming from. I respectfully disagree at times, but at the end of the day, Republican or Democrat shouldn't play a role in serving people. It should start with a love of people, a love of God, and a heart to serve.
Okay, so you believe that getting the work done is going to mitigate the partisan politics and representation for the district?
Well, yes, sir. I say my focus will always be on serving people. And okay. When they bring me issues, I will do my best to try to bring solutions.
Okay, so we have another caller. Reginald is on the line from Orange Park. Reginald, good morning and welcome to First Coast Connect. Good morning,
Reginald. Hi, good morning. Yes, sir. Hey, I'll be brief. Sir, your appointment is temporarily. Like was mentioned earlier, you got an election coming up shortly that's going to possibly change everything. How do you believe that you can do anything to bring about any significant change for the people? There's been so many people that goes, oh, God, and praise God, and all this, but yet and still their heart is far from it, all right? You got Pentecostal pimps who claim to be men of God, but yet still they live next door to rich rap stars, all right? So what I'm asking you, brother, is this. Are you sincere, or can you really make a change, or is this just a filler?
All right, thank you. Thank you for that, Reginald. The question is what do you reasonably believe you can get done in a short period of time that wasn't been done before? Right. You've got a very short window in order to represent the district. Should you decide to run for District 10? And that's another question we're going to ask here. But what do you think you can get done in a short period of time to show the people of District 10 that you're properly representing the district for their needs and not for any other political gain?
Yes, sir. And what can be done? Well, I'll tell you, in the next couple of days, there will be another initiative rolling out here.
Can you tell us what it is?
I would like to hold on to that just for a little bit longer. I'm still in some conversations with folks. But going in and just leveraging relationships, meeting people. And as I stated earlier, for several weeks, this district went without any representation. No one sitting at the table fighting for their needs when they're calling with their issues and concerns. So the first several weeks in, my job was to catch up on all of those issues turned in on 630 City, care tickets, find out where we're at in the process and try to bring those problems to a closure, all while still showing up to the Johnson Y, the Legend Center, everywhere I could go, the senior centers, and meeting people and introducing myself to them because I know that their questions. I know people don't know that I've been involved in working in the community for over the last 12 years mm-hmm. or a decade.
So how's that working?
I believe that it's working well. And when you talk to people in the community, no disrespect to anyone that's come before me, but I've heard time and time again, you called me back, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Freeman, you visited my house to see my issue, and it was resolved. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank the city workers. I want to thank the administration because without their support, these things wouldn't get done in the quick turnaround that they've been done.
So what can people in District 10 look for now that hadn't been done previously that you've gotten done in a short period of time? And also, what can, you said you couldn't tell us what the project is, but, give us a snapshot of what you think your vision is in this short period of time for District 10. And also tell us if you're going to run for District 10.
Yes, sir. Well, I kind of go off of a philosophy of, you got to take small bites of the apple. And so when I visited all parts of our district, and thanks to Chief Patterson, who took me down every street of the district, I can say I've done that. There are a lot of challenges. There are a lot of areas where you see flooding and you see sidewalks and you see overgrown trees. And so to the point where it breaks your heart. And so when you say what can be done, well, you have someone who's going to show up daily, who's going to come back downtown and go and have those one-on-one meetings with the decision makers and put forth an argument of this is what needs to be done for our residents to be able to accomplish their fullest potential. If it's our kids getting to school, if it's folks getting to jobs, these are the things that need to be done.
And so you believe that you have a different influence over the council and administration that someone who may be a Democratic representative in District 10 would have.
Well,
and because of that, you feel like you can get more done.
I've been told that my party's in the majority. I heard a caller say that earlier. Mm-hmm. In the town halls, I've heard them say it. And I remind folk in town halls, it takes 10 votes to get things done in City Hall. I'm one of a body of 19. So going off of that logic that you're in the majority, I would hope and like to think that I'm able to present the discussion or present my side of a discussion to a way that my peers hear it, they understand it, and they want to see this part of our city move forward in a direction as well.
Okay, so we have another call. Aaron is on the north side. We're going to get Aaron in here. Good morning, Aaron. How are you doing? Welcome to First Coast Connect.
How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Awesome. Listening to the show, I'm enjoying it. Listening to Mr. Terrence. And not to beat a dead horse, Mr. Stanley just called a few minutes ago and made the comment about Mr. Terrence being from the Republican Party representing a Democratic district. And I don't think that that's the big issue. I guess what I have a concern with this whole thing, and I want to applaud him for what he's doing already and what he's trying to do. I think that whether he's Republican or Democrat, either way, the community can be served. My parents live in the district, so I definitely have an interest. What's almost disappointing to me is where our system, political system is going, because of what it looks like to me is that any person can be appointed to a community by a governor, by a mayor, whoever has that authority, and not necessarily represent that community. So in his case, I think that it's unfair, no matter how qualified and Christian he is and service to the community he's done in the past. I think that I don't think it sets a good precedent that we appoint someone from outside of the neighborhood and then that person moves in to be legitimate. I don't think that that's the way that it's supposed to be done. If I favor a particular area of town and the last day to qualify to run is this coming Saturday and I move to the district a day ahead, I don't really think that's fair for me to represent that neighborhood because I moved there for the purpose of serving.
Thank you for that, Terrence.
And it looks like that's what's happened here.
Yeah, thank you for that, Terrence. Thank you for your comment. So what do you say to people, and we talked about this a little bit, but what do you say to people who feel absolutely strongly about the fact that while the governor has every right to appoint who he wants, it is unfair for him to appoint someone who is not representative politically of the makeup of the district? Because some of the conversations that we've heard is that this would never happen in Mandarin.
Right, and I think
you wouldn't appoint a Democrat to represent
we're speculating, right? Yeah, well, Aaron, thank you for that question, and I think it's a two-part answer because you start off by hearing what are your qualifications, what qualifies you, why do you think you'll do a good job, and then you share that, and then it goes back to the process. Now we're on the process, and so what I share with folks with the process. One, I've been coaching and mentoring in this city for a long time, all parts of our city. Many of those days spent were spent in and around District 10. There are relationships that were built, but more so than anything else, when they come to me with a process, Charles, I understand this more clear than ever before. I have two ears and one mouth. And I didn't care how, when people say, what did you learn about the people of District 10? I understand, I've learned how passionate they are about their community. And I've learned that anything that you're passionate about, you become emotional about it. So I didn't care how the tone of what they were saying to me. All I was doing was listening and hearing their hearts and hearing their concerns. And so when I hear those questions about process, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it, but we're here now. And I said, we're here now and we're here until March of the election. And mm-hmm. in June when I'm out, let's see what we can partner together and do in this period.
Okay. So do you think that at any point so far, have you been at a political disadvantage on behalf of the district or vice versa? Do you think the residents of the district have been at a political disadvantage because of your party affiliation?
I would say at the local level, party doesn't play much. And so
some of the Democratic city council members will argue with that, but
they very well can. But I've also been a part of this process for a while and been behind the curtain and have watched how this city moves forward. And we are a city of loving people. I support and applaud the mayor in his efforts of moving Jacksonville towards one city, one Jacksonville. Now, do we have challenges? Absolutely. Will we always have challenges? Yes. But we're going to continue to work forward to continue to bring our city together, to be the great city. And it is a good city. It's a great city now, but to be even greater. I get excited when I start thinking about the shipyards, and I get excited when I think about the development coming with the district in downtown, because I understand that those are opportunities that are going to be provided jobs, increasing the tax base so that we are able to do more things for our city as a whole.
So are you going to run for election in District 10?
I've said it from the very beginning. I am going to continue to work hard, wake up every day and work hard in the district. And if the people of District 10, they come to me in masses and say, Mr. Freeman, we want you to represent us, by all means, I will. If they call and say, go pound sand, I'll say thank you for my time of service. And I will continue to look forward and look for other opportunities to serve in whatever capacity that may be.
Hasn't taken you very long to learn how to talk like a politician, right? Nice answer. We got Jose on the north side. Jose, welcome to First Coast Connect and good morning.
Hey, good morning. I see nothing wrong with a Republican running in that district. Are we going to be in the political insanity, trying the same over and over with no results? Little results. Why don't we have somebody with a different mentality to bring something different? What have the previous politician done for that district? Minimum. So what's wrong with this guy? I see nothing wrong with it.
Thank you, Jose. Thank you, Jose, for that comment. I don't think that people see anything wrong with you personally. This probably their political affiliation has represented them. They're representing them throughout since the district has been there. And this is a little bit of a change, so to speak, and the expectations are high for you over there. So tell us about what do you think if you had to complete one thing by June 30th, what would that be?
That's a great question. Where would I start? For the district. I think, I don't know if I can narrow it down to one thing. I have several things on my list, but it's important for me to reiterate that I'm willing to work with anyone. Doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican. Doesn't matter how tall, if you're black, if you're white. If they want help and they bring it to my attention, I'm going to help them. And that was a challenge I brought out in the town halls is put me to the test. Bring your concerns, bring your challenges. So when you say a big thing, infrastructure, going through some places like Carver International and seeing several days after rain, there's standing water in yards. When I talked to Ms. Olivine, going over and talking to Mr. Solomon and hearing some of his concerns about the roads and the lighting, those things, they slowly move up. But I don't want to say it was what the Terrence want. It was mm-hmm. really what did the people of District 10 want. And I've gotten out and I've met with them and I've spoken with them and I've heard their voices. Public safety infrastructure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Terrence Freeman, thank you for being here this morning. We thank you for being here and doing and taking all the calls and taking all the heat. And we'll look forward to seeing what you do for District 10 in the future.
Thank you so much. And I just want to let everyone, my heart, my thoughts and prayers go out to the victims of the hurricane and to our first responders that are over there helping in the relief efforts.
Thanks for that. Much more still ahead. Later, it's a landmark new exhibit at the Cummer Museum featuring one of this area's most influential artists, Augusta Savage. But up next, providing help and hope to those seeking shelter from domestic violence. Back in a moment.
Ansbacher Law. When buying or selling real estate, a board-certified real estate attorney can help transactions go smoothly and protect your interests. Barry Ansbacher, Florida Bar, board-certified in real estate law since 1995. More at 737-4600 or ansbacherlaw.com. Nemours is not simply a place for care. Nemours is a way of caring for children. Our promise means we'll do whatever is in our power to help children grow up healthy, regardless of ability to pay. You can help. Nemours.org/ourpromise.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jacksready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Welcome back. Well, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and the need for shelter and services for victims of domestic violence in this area is greater than ever. Here with more, we welcome Gail Patton, CEO of Hubbard House in Jacksonville, and Joyce Mayer, CEO of Betty Griffin Center in St. Johns County. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start off by talking about, what are some of the numbers around some domestic violence? And we know that in this age now and the climate that we've been hearing more about domestic violence and violence against women altogether. So talk a little bit about what's going on in the community and what we don't know about domestic violence.
Well, I can speak for Duval County and Hubbard House. We see well over 4,500 people a year that we provide services to. And if you know anything about domestic violence, that doesn't account for all the people because some people don't come forward. And what we're learning is that when people don't come forward to get help from Hubbard House or their local shelter, that those are the people that are dying. Shelters provide life-saving and life-changing services, and we want people to know that we're here to help as well as the other shelters.
And that's true for St. Johns County as well, for the Betty Griffin Center. Last year, we saw over 3,500 individuals that came to us for all our different services. And so our shelter continues to be over capacity, I would say 45% of the time. So, you know, people are calling and coming in. But we really need to get the information out to those that, you know, need further services for St. Johns County.
Do you know how many people lost their lives as a result of domestic violence from an intimate partner? Do you know, was there something specific that would be, I mean, to really paint the picture for us here in our area?
Well, in Duval County in 2017, there were 15 domestic violence deaths. 9 of them were due to intimate partner violence. Some of them were the partners or boyfriends, girlfriends, husbands, wives, but 2 were other people. One was an adult daughter who was there to help her mother, and when he killed his partner, he killed the adult daughter as well. Mm. And 1 was a 3-year-old child who was shot in the head dead in front of his 5-year-old brother. So domestic violence not only impacts the intimate partner, it impacts family members. It impacts other people in the area. It's not just a crime that isolates itself totally to the home, because we also see an overlap between domestic violence and people who are committing other mass shootings as well.
So how do you help victims?
Well, in St. Johns County, we have a full array of comprehensive holistic services. So what we want to do is look at that survivor and really wrap services around them to give them safety, but also support. So, you know, we provide emergency shelter, legal representation, counseling, you know, other variety services that we offer to support that survivor and their children. And, you know, you have to remember that the majority, there's about half of our survivor population that come into shelter that are children. So we're working with children on an individual basis and as a group as well.
I would agree with Joyce, what she said they do in St. Johns County, we do at Hubbard House as well. And then another part that Joyce and I have been talking about for some time, and she's actually been at the forefront of this, is really pushing batterer accountability. If we hold batterers accountable, that's the people who are doing the crime. So we can protect the victim, which is good, and give them options and services and support. But until we get at the root of the problem and hold batterers accountable, when I mean we, I mean everybody in the system, the whole mm-hmm. society, then we're not stopping it where it starts.
So how difficult is that to hold batterers accountable?
Well, actually, in St. John's County, we have a pilot project for, which is the first one in the nation. And so what we do is we have a batter accountability specialist that works within our child welfare system. And what Joe does is engage the batterer into making sure that, see if he wants to work with his case plan through Department of Children and Families, or if there's an injunction for protection, he makes sure that all of the tasks are followed as well that's required of him or her on the injunction for protection. And if that's not being followed, then what he does is he'll call, he'll do an order to show cause to the judges, and then the judges brings them back in, and either they will comply with their requirements or there we could be consequences for that. So it's been a real successful program so far, and we're really looking forward to continuing that, perhaps maybe statewide.
Yeah. So how do you get the message to women that the system is there to protect them? Because what we hear is that women don't report or they don't come forward because they feel like they can't be protected. The batterer is going to get out or get loose or get free. It's not going to be held accountable to the point where they can feel safe.
Well, having shows like this and other venues where we can talk about the services out there is very, very important. And giving hotline number, the statewide hotline number is 1-800-500-1119. People can call that 24 hours a day and get help. There is somebody at the other end of that line who can let them look at what resources they have. But also just to let people know that there are so many ways that we can intervene, not just Hubbard House or Betty Griffin Center, but also the police here in Jacksonville are very good responding to domestic violence. We have a very good relationship with them. And the courts really do care about what happens with a survivor. It's just very scary for survivors to come forward because the batterer has often told them, if you come forward, I'm going to kill you. And that can be one of the most dangerous times for a victim, children, extended family, is when they decide to get help and or leave the relationship. So calling that hotline first and thinking about a safe way to do it is so important.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people to know that information and number. You might want to give it one more time.
Yeah, it's 1-800-500-1119. I also want to add to that, collaborative partnerships within your community is extremely important because, you know, Hubbard House can't do it alone. Betty Griffin Center can't do it alone. So we need to work with our partners and our community, but also we need the community as a whole to be a part of the solution. And as advocates, we want to be voices for those that are in fear of speaking out. But also when the community comes together and supports survivors, then other survivors are more comfortable coming out and speaking out against the issue.
All right. Thank you very much for being here this morning. Gail Patton with Hubbard House and Joyce Mayer from Betty Griffin Center. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Many places in downtown Jacksonville being considered for demolition or redevelopment have had their histories lost. How can we bring these stories back to life while determining a future for these sites? WJCT, in partnership with Modern Cities, present The Jackson, Forgotten Spaces, Tuesday, October 23rd at WJCT Studios. The evening begins with a reception at 6, followed by a panel discussion at 6:30. RSVP for this free event at wjct.org/events, sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
WJCT readers are here for you. With the Florida Times Union complete with news, op-eds, and obits, our readers will bring the paper to life to serve those with blindness and other physical challenges. Need our service? Go online to wjct.org/radio reading. Listen there and register as a listener, or we'll send you a special radio free. Call us at 904-358-6308, because at Radio Reading, we give voice to the printed word.
Welcome back. Well, a local artist who was instrumental in the famed Harlem Renaissance is being featured in a major exhibit at the Kummer Museum. Augusta Savage, who was born in 1892 in Green Cove Springs, overcame poverty, racism, and sexual discrimination to become one of the country's most influential sculptures of the 20th century, playing a pivotal role in the development of some of this country's most celebrated artists. Museum's acting director, Holly Karras, and the guest curator, Dr. Jeffreen Hayes, are here with more. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, so tell us about the exhibit.
Well, this is a project that the Kummer Museum has been working on for more than 10 years at this point. Jeffreen formally joined the project back in 2015, and we are just so excited to be able to share the life, the legacy, the inspirational story, the heartache, everything about Augusta Savage, who, as you say, is a little bit of a hometown hero for us that needs greater national attention.
So what made the Kummer Museum want to do an exhibit around Augusta Savage?
Well, you know, Mrs. Kummer actually had one of Augusta Savage's pieces. It's called The Diving Boy, and at the time it was located in the Italian Garden at the foot of one of those reflecting pools. And so that's been something that we felt very passionate about.
Yeah. So Dr. Hayes, tell us about your role in making this exhibit happen.
So I'm the guest curator. I was invited in to provide the research, the exhibition framework, and help the Kummer present the show to the community.
So really, I don't think that a lot of people from the community are very familiar with Augusta Savage. They may have heard the name, but they don't know the artist, the sculptor, and all of the impact that she brought to the artistic world, and not just here in Florida and in the South area, but across the, you know, around the world. So talk a little bit about the impact that Augusta Savage had on the art world itself and the art history behind the work she's completed.
Sure. So Augusta Savage was a leading artist of the Harlem Renaissance, also known as the Negro Renaissance. And she, in addition to being an artist, she was also an educator and an organizer. And so with her artistic skill, it was really important for her to pass on that knowledge to the next generation. And so she is really pivotal behind some of the most celebrated artists, like Jacob Lawrence. She mentored him. She didn't necessarily teach him. Norman Lewis, who was a student of hers. Ernest Crishlow, Gwen Knight. And a lot of the Black artists during this time, whether they were in New York or making their way to New York, they were all told that they needed to find Augusta Savage.
Wow.
She was the center in Harlem.
Was it her work that took her from Green Cove or this area to New York and other parts of the world? Or was it she just decided that she needed to be somewhere else in order to do the work that she was trying to do?
It was probably a little bit of both. I mean, her talent certainly got her to New York. I mean, she was an incredibly, incredibly gifted artist, you know, getting a scholarship to Cooper Union School of Art and finishing a 4-year curriculum in 3 years. So she had the talent that was needed, but she also had the drive and the determination to make it possible.
So what is it that visitors will see when they come in through the Kummer to see the exhibit?
Well, there are about 80 works of art, including some photographs and some archival letters, 19 sculptures by Augusta Savage, plus one of her watercolors. And as Jeffreen said, a selection of works from people who she mentored in the art world.
Yeah. So how tough was it to make this happen?
Well, it took about 3 years. You know, we're borrowing from about 20 individual and institutional lenders in addition to the works that the Kummer Museum owns. So that takes a lot of coordination.
Okay. And how long will the exhibit be running?
The exhibit is up at the Kummer until the first week in April. And then after that, it's traveling nationally to the New York Historical Society, to the Palmer Museum at Penn State, and then the Dixon Gallery and Gardens.
So what about in the community, if people want to take special advantage of, are there things going on, there are special tours for kids or groups or you know, churches? You know, how are you making this available in diverse ways to the community?
Lots of different ways. We have a pretty extensive program plan that people can find on our website, kummermuseum.org. And we have a number of community partners who are working with us to make sure that this story gets out. To your question specifically about school tours, one of the reasons we're running it for this time period is really to be able to capitalize on getting our student population in. And Dr. Green, the new school superintendent for Duval County, has committed to get all the fourth graders mm-hmm. in and have the county pay the transportation for that.
It sounds good. This is an exciting exhibit, and I've heard so much about it. I was talking to some people earlier this week, and we're anticipating it coming to, you know, being ready for Jacksonville for Kummer. And so you all ought to be proud about that. Dr. Hayes, what do you see? What do you like to see come out of this exhibit? You've been working on it for a while. It's kind of your baby, so to speak. What do you see coming out of this exhibit, and what do you see next, and how does it fit into this community itself? What does it say to the community?
There's a lot. Taking on the project, I was really interested in not only reclaiming Augusta Savage's legacy and lifting it in art history and in our culture, but also the Jacksonville community coming around and learning that one of their own has made this really deep impact. And so as the show travels, my hope is that communities that may not know about Augusta Savage, may not know the Augusta Savages in their own communities, will come around and be inspired by the show. I also hope that it spurs more exhibitions on Augusta Savage.
What kind of impact do you think this has had on local artists, you know, so far, especially Black artists and artists of color here? Because, you know, we have a growing art community here and it's very diverse. What type of impact do you think it's had on, or will have?
I think it's having a really deep impact. I've only been in Jacksonville for a week. I've been back and forth over the past week, and I've met with some of the artists, the Black artists in this community, and they are so deeply inspired by not only Augusta Savage, but the Kummer presenting an exhibition on this Black artist okay. who has made, again, like just a very deep impact in this community.
All right. Thank you very much for being here. Holly Karras and Jeffreen Hayes, thank you for the exhibit.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back.
Ansbacher Law assists condo and homeowners associations facing challenges with collecting delinquent assessments. Barry Ansbacher has a dedicated collections department that is sensitive to the needs of your community. More at 737-4600 or jackscondolawyer.com. Nemours is not simply a place for care. Nemours is a way of caring for children. Our promise means we'll do whatever is in our power to help children grow up healthy, regardless of ability to pay. You can help. Nemours.org/ourpromise. Many places in downtown Jacksonville being considered for demolition or redevelopment have had their histories lost. How can we bring these stories back to life while determining a future for these sites? WJCT, in partnership with Modern Cities, present The Jackson, Forgotten Spaces, Tuesday, October 23rd at WJCT Studios. The evening begins with a reception at 6, followed by a panel discussion at 6:30. RSVP for this free event at wjct.org/events, sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
I'm Marco Werman in the World's Newsroom with a story about Democrats in Arizona. They're looking for a win in November, and they're counting on support from Latino voters. But many Arizona Latinos are conservative. For example, some of them want a border wall.
They don't respond in sort of that knee-jerk fashion that if you're for secure borders, that means you don't like brown people.
Why stereotypes don't begin to explain Arizona politics. It's on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
The animated comedy BoJack Horseman has been dealing with difficult real-life issues for 5 seasons.
What you're saying is, everything is society's fault, and we as individuals never need to take responsibility for anything.
No, not exactly. I was just saying that...
I like that.
Meet the mind behind a horse-human hybrid next time on 1N. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. And finally this hour, it's a celebration of local authors and literary in the literary scene. The Jack's by Jack's Literary Arts Festival is coming up this Saturday in historic Riverside, Avondale. Darrellyn Coon is the festival director, and Tim Gilmore is here to discuss this event. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I understand it's the 5th annual, right? So tell us a little bit about what to expect from the Literary Arts Festival.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Darrellyn Coon for taking it off my hands this year. I organized it with a lot of help the last few years, and last year I just felt worn out, and she's done an outstanding job with it. The way Jack's by Jack's works is there are a number of venues around Park and King Street in Riverside, places like Cool Moose Coffee House and Jacksonville Magazine, Riverside Liquors, lots of others. And writers perform their work, whether it be poetry or fiction or memoir or creative nonfiction or folklore. It's an opportunity to, really enjoy the neighborhood and the city and have a good time and listen to the city's literary voices.
Well, first of all, anything that happens in Riverside Avondale is always deemed to be cool. So add Jack's by Jack's to that and include that. But so we're talking about local artists here. Local writers who are here and they perform their works. What kind of a atmosphere do we have for that? Do we have a lot of local artists here literary people here who write books, write poetry, that's that vibrant that they can take on and produce a festival?
We absolutely do. And they are from all walks of life. They write in all the different genres, and they're all ages. We start the day, as a matter of fact, with a student showcase at the Women Writing for a Change building, and that goes from 1:30 to 2:30, and then from 3 to 6 we move to that area near the corner of Park and King Streets and have the 12 venues with 24 writers. And then at 6:30 we're going to have an after party at Yellow House Art.
After party.
It's going to be great. And we're going to have further readings there. We're going to have a flash reading put on by Bridge 8 Press. So that'll be exciting.
So what does it look like? Does it, the writers and performers, are they in these particular venues and they're just there reading their works, or they're staged all at one time, or they're scheduled throughout the day?
Well, two writers share a venue.
Mm-hmm.
And each writer will read or perform 3 different times for about 15 minutes. So you can look at the schedule of events at jacksbyjacks.com. And you can kind of, I always think of it as choose your own adventure, those children's books that I personally loved when I was a kid. You can kind of figure out who you want to hear and when, and you can go hear someone at the comic book store at 3 and then go down to, Flair Celebrations and hear somebody at 3:30. And if you miss somebody at 3 that you really wanted to hear, you can also catch them at 4 and at 5. So, it's a lot of cross-pollination, in the center of the neighborhood.
So is it all local writers and performers, or do people come in from other areas of the country to showcase their work?
This is Jacksonville Writers Writing Jacksonville. And so what we do is we say you can submit to Jacks by Jacks, and it is curated. We're taking the best of the applicants. You need to be born here. You need to live here now, or you need to write about Jacksonville, set your fiction here or write memoir about it. So they are all local. And we hope that that will be an inspiration to people who say, I would like to be a writer, But, you know, I just live here in the little town where I was born, and I don't live in a big city, and maybe I shouldn't aspire to be a writer, but we want to show Jacksonville that there are people here doing exactly what you're dreaming of doing, and they're making a success of it.
Yeah, so we hear that there's a student showcase as well. So it's not all grown-ups trying to, you know, dibble-dabble over there, but there are students who are trying to find their way as well. Talk a little bit about what they bring to the festival.
Well, so FSCJ's Matt Laney, who is a wonderful writer himself, you know, selects from student applications. And as Darlin said, this will be down at Women Writing for Change on Osceola Street. And there are students from...
students from FSCJ and UNF. And we've got four high school students from Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. So we're very excited to hear from them as well.
Okay. All right. So it sounds very, very exciting. I mean, almost inspires me to want to write something down, yeah. You know, a couple of words on a piece of paper and come out and read, right? And this is another one of those events here in Jacksonville. There's a ton of things to do here in this great city. And sounds like the Jacks by Jacks Literary Fest is one of those things.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you. So you have?
I just wanted to mention one thing. We will have a pop-up bookstore. San Marco Books and More is going to do a pop-up bookstore right there on Park Street. And you will be able to buy the books from 1 to 6 p.m. and take them with you to the readings and have the authors sign them. Right, or they can sign them at the after party.
All right. Thank you very much, Darlin Kuhn and Tim Gilmore. Thanks for being here.
We appreciate it.
And that's our show. Thanks to all our guests and callers. Our producer today has been Jessica Palumbo. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed anything this morning, you can hear a rebroadcast tonight at 8. 1A is up next. I'm Charles Griggs, and thank you for being here.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.